طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح، طفلة تمتطي.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice, that is too often missing in the mainstream presentation of news and analysis in the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is continued in his memory. This is John Roberts. Last week on This Week in Palestine, we featured our first edition of the Israel-Palestine panel at the Left Forum held at the John Jay College in New York City at the end of May 2016. This week we continue coverage of the panel with Tariq Ali and Norman Finkelstein. Tariq Ali is a British-Palestinian writer, journalist, and filmmaker. He is a member of the editorial committee of the New Left Review and contributes to The Guardian, Counterpunch, and the London Review of Books. Norman Finkelstein is a political scientist, activist, professor, and author. His primary fields of research are the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and the politics of the Holocaust, an interest motivated by the experiences of his parents who were Jewish Holocaust survivors. We return to our recording of the New Left Forum with a question to Norman Finkelstein poised by the panel moderator Paul Jay of Baltimore's Real News Network.
I'm going to ask Norman to respond to the first point that Tariq raises about there really is no two-state solution left to be had, and it's now a one-state issue. And then I'm going to ask Norman to respond on the BDS question, the whole issue of sanctions.
I hope that Paul won't be offended, but I feel like the one-state, two-state has been argued to the point of tedium, and I want to make some other remarks, and if we have time, I'll come back to that, if that's okay.
Sure.
I want to begin with the question that Paul, or the scenario, or the interview that Paul had in Lebanon with this young woman who wanted to strangle the Israeli children, young Israeli Palestinian child who wanted to strangle the Israeli children. And it conjures up an image of this seething anger and brutality on both sides, and how the conflict has corrupted both sides. And I think there's a certain amount of it creates a picture which is highly distorted and inaccurate. I find, and I don't say this in any kind of malice, I've past the age in my life where I have to vent my anger, inner anger or malice towards other people. I try to be as objective as I can when it comes to the politics. So I'm not saying it in malice, but I don't think there is a rational basis for this Israeli seething anger at Palestinians. If you look at what actually happens during these conflicts, say, between Israel and Gaza, the balance sheet is so wildly imbalanced that the notion that both sides suffer or both sides have comparable grievances is simply preposterous. And during Operation Protective Edge, one Israeli house was destroyed. 19,000 Palestinian homes were destroyed. One Israeli child was killed. 550 Palestinian children were killed. 20,000 tons. 20,000 tons of explosives were dropped on Gaza. At the outside, maybe 40 tons were dropped on Israel from these Gaza fireworks. There was no war. There was some fighting inside Gaza, which unprecedentedly, it cost the lives of 67 Israeli soldiers. That was unusual, mostly because of the effectiveness of the tunnel system they had created. But that aside, you take a place like Shujaya, 90,000 people crammed into this tiny area. Israel dropped more than 100 one-ton bombs. More than 100 one-ton bombs on Shujaya. How can anyone in his or her right mind compare that remotely to what happens in Israel? I'll admit, before I say it, there's an element of hyperbole. I'll admit there's an element of exaggeration. However, it's not so wildly exaggerated to say that I face more danger on the boardwalk of Coney Island on July 4th than 99% of Israelis face during these wars with Gaza. Those are fireworks. They are not rockets. They are not missiles. As a matter of fact, I met a Gazan who told me in Gaza they call them belly dancers because they swivel when they go up into the air. Everybody knows they are a joke. Now, let me now turn to the question of what's possible. What can be done about an appalling situation? There have been two, or I should say, in the history of the Palestinian struggle, there have been basically three strategies that have been tried. One, everybody's familiar with, the diplomacy, which begins technically in 1993 with the Oslo Agreement. There's no point in squandering precious time trying to demonstrate to you that it's failed. It manifestly has failed. When the Oslo Agreement was signed, there were about 250,000 illegal Jewish settlers in the occupied Palestinian territories. Now there are about 600,000. If you judge an agreement not by its verbal claims, but by its actual outcomes, Oslo was not a peace process, it was an annexation process. The goal was to annex the most desirable parts of the West Bank, and that process unfolded with a certain kind of methodicalness over the past 20, 25 years. Diplomacy is a dead end. The other strategy practiced right now has been the armed struggle, the armed resistance of Hamas. Now, under international law, Hamas, the Palestinians, nothing in international law debars them from using armed force to end the occupation. That is, let's put it, I won't use the technical language because I'm on tape and then people are going to try to get to me. Nothing under international law debars them from using armed force to end the occupation. For me, that's not an important question. Legally, they have the right. Morally, in my opinion, they have the right. But then there's the political question. The political question is very simple. Does it work? Is it working? Is it a viable strategy? So let's set aside the legal question, where I think Palestinians have the right. The moral question, I think they have the right. But then let's look at the political question. Does it work? Does it have the potential of working? You judge for yourself. Since 2008-09, since Operation Cast Lead, there have been three Israeli operations, really massacres, though the second one wasn't quite in the same level. Operation Cast Lead, Operation Pillar of Defense in November 2012, and then Operation Protective Edge. Each time Hamas went to battle with Israel, each time they set the same goal, always the same, to end the blockade of Gaza. That was the goal. We want to end the blockade of Gaza. Each time, at the end, there was some sort of promise or commitment to ending the blockade. We're now in 2016, 2 years after Protective Edge. Was the blockade lifted? It's not working. The strategy doesn't work. There's a kind of mutual gain by both sides in pretending that there's such thing as armed resistance. So Hamas says, look, our rockets work. The Israelis are so afraid of them. So they get to say armed resistance is working. Then the Israelis say, they're attacking us with rockets. What do you expect us to do? Or as Mr. Obama likes to say, that they have the right to defend themselves. It was my two daughters. What would I expect? You know, stupefying narcissist. So both sides have a stake in pretending this thing called armed resistance works. It does not. And then you have to ask yourself, what's left? And there is, in the history of the Palestinian movement, there is the third option, which was remarkably successful. And that was the mass nonviolent resistance of the First Intifada. Most people are much too young to remember, but it was a remarkably successful mass uprising which hurt Israel at two fundamental levels. Number one, disaster for Israel in terms of public relations. Kids with stones, and then Defense Minister Yitzhak Rabin issues an order. It was called a force, might, and beatings. And then the Israeli army went around and systematically broke the bones of Palestinian children. That didn't do great on the news internationally. It was a disaster for Israel, for those who remember. And secondly, it was a disaster for Israel because huge numbers of Israelis had to be called up, reservists, 500,000 at a time, in order to put down the uprising. The nonviolence resistance, in general, as a tactic, it has real possibilities. The question is, now what to do? In my opinion, there is a real possibility now. One of the paradoxes of the Israel-Palestine conflict is, objectively, in fact, things have never looked better, aside from the fact that other parts of the Arab world are now getting a huge amount of attention, which never before happened. Syria, Iraq, I don't have to go through it with you. And that steals the camera from the Palestinians. But aside from that development, which I recognize is not trivial, it's never been better. Objectively, a huge amount of public opinion now is ready to put pressure on Israel. An even huger amount of public opinion in Europe is now ready to put pressure on Israel. The challenge in politics, I know Tariq doesn't like him, and I don't care. The challenge in politics is what Gandhi always said is, it's how do you get people to act on what they already know is wrong. Politics is not about, as people in my generation used to say, and probably Tariq still says, it's not about trying to raise people's consciousness. Because everybody knows a thousand things are already wrong. The question is how to get them to act on what they already know is wrong. And that was the genius of the Bernie Sanders campaign. He didn't try to raise anybody's consciousness. He just started to say things that everybody's been thinking every minute of every day. I can't pay my loans. I can't find a job. I can't move out of my parents' home. I can't. And all of a sudden, Bernie started to say what people already knew was wrong. That's the challenge. How to get them to act on what they already know is wrong. And there is a real possibility here. The way you get people to act, Gandhi said, is you engage in mass nonviolent resistance, and you may think it doesn't sound like a profound revolutionary text. He says you have to be willing to get your bones broken to evoke people's pity and sympathy. That's how you get people to act. Now, it may not sound so profound, but for those of you who lived during the civil rights movement, what got people to act? When they saw dogs, the dogs on the kids. When they saw people, the water cannons on the kids. When you saw some volunteers getting killed. When you saw Emmett Till and you saw what happened to his face. That's what gets people to act. People think Gandhi's nonviolence was, about, Om, and if you planning to go to San Francisco, make sure to have a flower in your hair. No, that wasn't Gandhi. If you read Gandhi, he says, if you want to be serious, you got to get your bones broken. You got to get your skull cracked. You got to get yourself killed. That's what he said nonviolence is about. If you read him, the real Gandhi, it's almost a kind of cult of death. But it's not like he's worshiping death. He's kind of realistic about what gets people to act. What gets people to move, to go from knowing something is wrong to actually doing something about it. Where are we at now? As I said, there have been major changes in public opinion. And then you have to find the right target. I know Tariq, his innards are probably writhing now, but Gandhi was very shrewd with the Salt March because he picked a target that affected everyone in Indian society but hurt the poor the most. It was a very clever target. It affected everyone, the salt tax, but of course it hurt the poor the most. What do we have now? There is something. It's the blockade of Gaza. It's a realistic goal. It is a realistic goal. I'll say it 10,000 times, and I am not Pollyannish. It's a realistic goal to end the blockade. Bernie Sanders, he made a point during his major interview, the blockade has to be lifted. That means we have Bernie on our side, and that's not trivial. That means a large number of people, more than anyone in his human memory could possibly imagine, more than the anti-war movement. That's a fact. If you have Bernie saying the blockade has to be lifted. 2 days ago, Haaretz newspaper, I was surprised, had ran an editorial, the blockade has to be lifted. It said, all this talk about we need it for security reasons, that's BS. Haaretz said it. Of course, it didn't say BS. Then the UN commission, the UN inquiry in Gaza, horrible. Somehow somebody sneaked in the line. Mary McGowan Davis, she must have been snoozing. Someone sneaked in the line. It said the blockade of Gaza has to be lifted immediately and unconditionally. It was unbelievable. It didn't say it has to be lifted conditional on no arms being smuggled into Gaza. It didn't say it had to be lifted conditional on Hamas not using the cement to build tunnels. It said immediately and unconditionally. There is a realistic prospect, if we do things right, to lift, to at least, in the short term, end the blockade of Gaza. That's what I think if the aim should be June 5th, 2017, the half century of the occupation. It began 50 years ago, June 5th. It means we have 1 year to organize. I think it's a realistic goal, except for one thing. I said all the objective factors are there. The problem is the subjective factor, because we can't, and frankly, I don't know, I have mixed feelings. We shouldn't want to do it from here. It has to start there. Tariq says that South Africa was liberated because of the Cubans at Cuito Carnaval. How is it pronounced? Cuito Carnaval. I think it was first and foremost. I'm not going to downplay the role the Cubans played, but first and foremost, there was a mass movement in South Africa. In the absence of a mass movement, it's simply not realistic that you can, so to speak, liberate Palestine from the outside. And I don't even think it's very desirable to liberate from the outside, because if you do it from the outside, tomorrow the people will be just as powerless and a band of crooks will take over. Of course, I have mixed feelings because it's a brutal blockade. And getting that lifted anyway, you know, has to be done. So the problem is the people of Gaza. People of Gaza are hopeless. And the leadership, I know Hamas was never given a chance. I know from the day they won those parliamentary elections, the screws started being turned. Then the CIA was organizing the coup in 2007. I know all the details. And I recognize those details. But the fact of the matter is, Hamas now is terrible. It's very repressive, and it's just looking out for itself. It's, you know, in the history of all political movements, you have that mentality where you think that the survival of the struggle is synonymous with the survival of your group, and then you start just defending your group. I'm not going to bring it up here because now Tariq will get angry at me again, but that's sort of what happened with the Bolsheviks, where they began to think survival of the Bolsheviks was survival of the revolution, and the two were synonymous. And the same thing has now happened with Hamas. I talk a lot to the people in Gaza over Skype and things like that, and the level of despair is just, it's very hard to correct. But if we could show them that we're ready to do our all, in my opinion, if we're ready to do our all, if they're ready to do their all, then there's a realistic prospect for ending the blockade of Gaza. And I think it's a worthy goal.
I won't get involved in an argument with Noam on Gandhi at this particular forum. I must say my views on Gandhi coming from that subcontinent are very different from the idealized picture which has been developed of him, not just by Noam, but by Western society as a whole. Interestingly enough, this I can't resist. I can't resist telling you this.
This is becoming a Marx Brothers routine. And Marx is appropriate here.
That in 1938, the Nobel Peace Prize Committee had a short list of people in front of it, and they couldn't decide whether to give the Nobel Peace Prize to Mahatma Gandhi, who, whatever my disagreements, certainly deserved it. They couldn't decide whether to give it to Mahatma Gandhi or Adolf Hitler.
Oh,
which shows how deep Western dilemmas go. But anyway, I agree on Gaza, of course. I would just say to Norman that what he's described, of course, another political theorist of a current, he now doesn't like the Bolsheviks, also once asserted that the chain breaks at its weakest link. And quoting Lenin's words, one can also reach the same conclusion that the weakest link in the chain of oppression in Israel-Palestine today is without doubt Gaza. And one should concentrate efforts, all possible efforts, to try and break the blockade. I'm completely in favor of that, have supported all the ships that have gone and all the different campaigns that have been involved. But that would be a huge leap forward and would possibly revitalize the mass movement in the rest of the region, because it's true, I took it for granted that the Cubans inflicting a military defeat on this vaunted, you know, white South African army was a huge blow to them. And Nelson Mandela, the first country he visited after he was released was Cuba. He said we owed them a blood debt, because without that defeat we might have been stuck for some time to come. But it goes without granted, there's a huge mass movement in South Africa, which varied, it was crushed, it rose again. You had new mass movements in Soweto and the townships. You then had armed struggle, strikes, guerrilla actions, which weren't so successful, by the way, even in South Africa. And then the Cuban triumph, and then we know the history. But the point I was going to make was that even with the blockade on Gaza being lifted, which would create the basis for a new, different type of mass movement of the Palestinians and their few allies in that region, we still have to have some overall plan which will not be fulfilled today or tomorrow or the day after. And that is where the question of what are your aims comes in, because if you have no plan, if the two-state solution is ended, you have to think, however unrealistic it might appear, at least pose the question of something else. And I think large parts of the world understand this now. Instinctively, it's true that in Europe, public opinion now, I mean, there have been a number of polls when they actually asked, which do you think is the most dangerous state in the world? A fairly large proportion of Europeans, especially the young, reply Israel. Why? Because they know Israel is a nuclear state. They know it's carrying out quite a brutal occupation. They know that the United States backs it. They fear that there could be an accidental nuclear war. Who knows what? As a war of last resort. So there is this growing feeling, which of course the elitist politicians in Europe don't represent and don't reflect. But some big shift and some big movement within the region itself could spark off real mass struggles or movements to put huge pressure on the governments of Europe and, I hope, North America. I mean, the thing about Bernie Sanders' campaign, which I should say, is that in all my memory of American politics, my own memories and experience, I have not seen a campaign like this. Someone will correct me if I'm wrong. That a campaign to become the candidate of a mainstream party virtually launches a huge popular movement and a popular political movement, not a single issue movement, in this country. Now, I know at the Left Forum there are many critics of Bernie, and fine, that's normal. But it's not even a question of his person, actually, in some ways. Why couldn't anyone else have triggered such a movement off? Precisely because of he's different from the others. People feel that. It was the same with Jeremy Corbyn in Britain. And when people were asked, but how can you like him? Bolster said, but why do you like him? The reply came, because he's different from the politicians. And the politicians are quite a hated subgrouping now, globally, but especially in Europe. And the fact that I think Sanders is the first serious senior politician of a political party who did not go to AIPAC, that does mark a small breakthrough, and we should be grateful.
Yeah.
Because that breaks... It does just break... It breaks the hold this organization has over the political structure. I mean, no other country... This is an imperial power, the most powerful country in the world. And after 9/11, both the Senate and the House voted a blank check. A blank check to Israel. Whatever you do, we will support you. Whatever you do, you can wipe out the entire Palestinian nation and we will support you. Unheard of. Unheard of. So, as time proceeds and as the decades pass by, it would be great to mark the 50th anniversary of the occupation, being able to celebrate something, and the lifting of the siege of Gaza, the sanctions on Gaza, the victimization of Gaza would be a huge step forward. So on that I'm in total agreement. It's not enough, of course, but it could be the pattern and the launch pad for something much, much bigger in the region. Because what is clear is that there's going to be no help from any other Arab state. Not that there was too much even before this, but at least during the days of Nasser and Arab nationalism, they tried, they gave them refuge, they trained them, they gave them weapons, they helped. That's all gone now, with the Saudi Arabians effectively on the same line as the Israeli government. Think about that. The most hardened faction within Islam, the Wahhabis, literalists, Islamic literalists, effectively on exactly the same line as Israel because of factional disputes against their rivals within Islam and because they are now fearful that something might happen inside their own country. So it's a very strange situation which releases the Palestinian movement in many ways from the Saudis and from these other countries, which helps a mass movement if it's politically and psychologically independent of some extremely unpleasant regimes in that region. Look, I don't live in the United States. I observe it from afar. I come here regularly, but not that often. And so I tend to see some of these issues not from the vantage point of someone who lives in the United States, but someone who lives in Britain but travels to the Middle East and other continents regularly too. And here I have to say that the BDS campaign, despite Norman's criticisms, we are not all wrong. I think some of the attacks on Norman have been completely unjustified. It's a perfectly legitimate debate. But I think that the BDS movement is the first global mass movement on the question of bringing Israel to heel and putting it in the court of international public opinion, and on that level one cannot deny its effect. It's been very effective. And the country where it's had the largest impact is South Africa, where huge numbers of delegations have gone and come back shocked by what they've seen, and said, don't even compare these Palestinian statelets to Bantustans. The Bantustans actually had more power than these Palestinian states do on the West Bank or on Gaza. So I think that is something that has to be recognized. And public opinion is a mobile thing. Today, public opinion is very worked up. There's no doubt about Gaza and the siege of Gaza, but it wasn't always thus. It has happened recently. And partially because of the campaigning that has gone round and because people have observed with their own eyes Israeli brutalities against the people of Gaza. So public opinion can change on other issues as well if properly handled. And I have seen the BDS activists in South America and elsewhere work very actively and very well in countries like Chile, even in Colombia, in the Bolivarian countries, obviously, but there they were backed by the state. Even in countries where they are not backed by the state, working extremely effectively to try and isolate Israel internationally. At a time when Israel is waging an offensive to become accepted as a normal state in a normal country. And here the country in Europe that has gone the farthest, even worse than the United States, is the Syriza government in Greece, which has recognized Jerusalem as the international capital of Israel, which even the United States has not done and refuses to do. Syriza has done it. And the links between the Syriza government and the Netanyahu government are now very close. Netanyahu government. Very close indeed. So this is a constant battle by the Israelis themselves for recognition of Israel as the state that it is. And this recognition, not the de facto, even the de jure recognition of Israel as a state, but acceptance of Israel as an occupying state in Palestine, that is what is at the heart of the debate. And that is the dispute. Who can question the existence of Israel? Who can challenge the existence of Israel? A nuclear country, the sixth most powerful army in the world, protected by the United States of America, which has threatened that anyone who tries to damage Israel will be blown off the face of this earth. And Hillary Clinton threatened to do that to the Iranians if they dared acquire nuclear weapons. I mean, just think and look at the double standards. So when the question of Israel is raised, no one, even if they say it, they know they don't mean Israel, and the Jewish population of Israel is safe and it is secure. The people who aren't safe and secure are the Palestinians. Are the Palestinian refugees, are the Palestinians in the occupied lands, and it is for them that the BDS campaign, with all its weaknesses, which campaign doesn't have weaknesses, has been extremely effective. And that is why I think it should be supported. And increasingly, as the debates carry on, and they do carry on, that's why they're trying to shut them down. People who organize these debates, even on university campuses on Britain, are told, no, you can't have a conference on this subject. Why? It threatens our security. We can't afford it. All these things are now coming in. Local councils who want to participate in the sanctions campaign are told it's illegal by the British government. You can't do it. In France, the Jewish Defense League can organize a demonstration through the streets of Paris. The BDS movement is not allowed to do so. And this is why, apart from everything else, it has become a central issue of democratic rights and civil liberties inside Europe itself, this campaign and this movement. Which is why, whatever disagreements you have, I would urge everyone to support it. One doesn't have to agree with every single dot and comma in it, because the work it is effectively doing is good, and it is also uniting many, many Jewish activists who are not Zionists, anti-Zionist Jewish activists, and Palestinians, and people who are neither, precisely because they see it as part of a peaceful campaign. When there was armed struggle being waged, as Norman has pointed out, by the Palestinians, of course, they were attacked as terrorists, they were attacked as violent. This, don't do this, we can't talk to you until you stop using violence, etc. When a peaceful, non-violent campaign, which is what BDS is organized, exactly the same. You're anti-Semites, you're not allowed to do this, you want to question the integrity of Israel. The people who are questioning the integrity of Israel are the Zionist leaders of that country. They're the ones who have brought Israel to this pass. It's not been the Palestinians. And every time, I remember a few years ago, I was at the Jewish, speaking at the Jewish Book Fair in London with two leading Zionists on either side of me, Jonathan Friedland of The Guardian and David Badia, quite a very decent comic and a very sweet guy apart from his Zionism. And he said, I said to them, since the Second Intifada, the Israeli government has decreed through its foreign ministries that all Israeli embassies are to step up the propaganda saying that anyone who opposes Israel is an anti-Semite. They didn't do this before, but they've done it since the Second Intifada. It's part of Israeli policy. And I said to this audience, the problem is this, that people of my generation know what anti-Semitism means and knows how deep its effects are and why it should be opposed. But if you say this to kids who are active in the movements against Israeli occupation today, they're not as affected as we are. And if you carry on like this, the kids will reply, we're going to carry on doing what we're doing. If you want to call us anti-Semites, so be it. And unfortunately, some of them are saying it. We don't care a damn what you call us. You know, it doesn't affect us anymore. They're saying it in France. They're saying it in parts of Britain. They're saying it in other parts of Europe. They're certainly saying it elsewhere. So it's against all this that movements like BDS, by raising deeper, more central issues, are, I think, extremely important.
You have been listening to Tariq Ali and Norman Finkelstein at a panel on Israel-Palestine featured at the Left Forum at the John Jay College in New York City, held at the end of May of this past year. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org, or if you wish to hear the program later in the day or any time after the broadcast within a two-week period via the WZBC archive, simply access the WZBC homepage and click on Archive and go to Sunday morning, 8 a.m., and click on Listen. We also have a permanent archive where you can access any of our past broadcasts, which is meticulously maintained by our Truth and Justice colleague, Stan Robinson. To reach our permanent archive to hear any past broadcast, go to truthandjusticeradio.org, all one word, truthandjusticeradio.org, and click on This Week in Palestine Archives. All our past broadcasts are on truthandjusticeradio.org archives. Thanks for listening, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday when our feature presentation will be the broadcast of a forum on boycott, divestment, and sanctions held at the Columbia University Law School with Professor Catherine Franke and Jewish Voice for Peace's Rebecca Vilcomerson. That is next week on This Week in Palestine. You are tuned to WZBC 90.3 FM, Newton, Massachusetts. And this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.